This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hi, Jason Gipps, Joy Production Manager. It's Radiothon time. We still need Joy and we need your support. If you appreciate our free podcast service, our voice for the LGBTI community globally, and the volunteers that make our service possible, please sign up, renew your Joy membership, or make a tax-deductible donation before June 30 to keep our service possible. You may win a prize. Head to joy.org.au and click on either the Become a Member or Donate tabs to support us. If you appreciate our podcast service, let us know in the comments section when making your donation. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them, at joy.org.au and on iTunes.
So once again, you are listening to Queercast with the ever fabulous Nick D.
and Emmerich Lau.
And today with us, we have one, our very special guest on a very special topic. Darling, welcome, welcome. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
First of all, thank you for having me here. I'm one, I've been Nicholas' friend for a long time right now.
Long time, girl, throwback.
You have seen me grow from like straight boy dating girls.
And soccer jerseys.
Soccer jerseys to like fabulousness right now.
Exactly. So, you know, we invited one today because, you know, we're sort of reacting to certain events that have happened in Asia, and I thought it was very timely to have you on the show to talk about, you know, what those events mean and sort of the circumstances surrounding these events. So, it's been a roller coaster week for Asia because there was good news and bad news, right? So, the good news is that Taiwan has ruled that, or at least has paved the way for marriage equality. So the courts have ruled that the current laws are unconstitutional, and then now it is up to Parliament to sort of enact new laws so that they can allow same-sex couples to get married. So fingers crossed, within 2 years, Taiwan will have gay marriage. Now, on the other hand, in Indonesia, we, you know, sort of read and heard about really disturbing news whereby first of all, two gay men were caned in Aceh publicly for having gay sex. And another incident was when the police in Jakarta, the capital, raided a gay bathhouse and arrested over 140 men. And during their arrest, the pictures of these men were leaked and then shared on social media. So it's in, being gay in Indonesia right now has effectively become a concern for your own safety and well-being, right? Because it is actually a threat to your safety to be in it. So if you are out there, you are listening, you know, be safe, right? And so it's on that point when I decided that, you know, hey, you know, we really need to be talking about this, because every time something like this happens, right, I feel that it is the opposition trying to force us back into the closet, right? And it is during that times like this that we need to speak up and we need to be visible. If not, we will be invisible.
Yes,
in that sense.
Exactly.
So I want to ask you, you know, what was it like growing up, you know, gay and Muslim?
The truth is, you don't grow up gay and Muslim.
Right.
You grow up Muslim.
Muslim.
Right. And then you go through this childhood of being Muslim. As most typical Muslim childhoods is like you go to a normal, at least in Singapore, and I'm not too sure about Indonesia or in or Malaysia. You go to a normal government school, you study secular topics, but then on the weekend, after school, you go to religious class.
Is that what you did when you were a kid?
So that's what I did. And my mom was a religious teacher. So
nice.
She is like the central figure of Islam to me. She was like, when I was growing up, I thought Islam was her. She was, in a way, the matriarch of Islam.
The matriarch of Islam.
So
like
whatever questions you had, you always defer to your mom, and
so
she would come back with an
definitive
answer.
Exactly, but her version of Islam is very much conservative.
Mm.
She demands like submission in a sense that you must pray 5 times a day, no questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
She's very strict, even with my dad. You know, so it's a very strict Muslim household. So
there are different strains of Islam, I understand.
Yes, there is. So within Islam, there are diversities, right? There are diversities even, like in the sense that some Muslims don't pray 5 times a day because they don't believe in the hadith.
Mm.
So the praying of 5 times a day comes not from the Quran, it comes from the Acts and deeds of the Prophet.
I see.
So they use the Prophet as an example to, since he does this, he did this, let's do it as well. So there are this kind of Muslim, they call Quranists, so they only believe the Quran. Then there are Muslims like, they call themselves reformist Muslims.
Okay.
Where they reform the religion for themselves, personally. And I think I fall into that category because I reject certain aspects of the Quran. So like most Muslims, they believe the Quran is this perfect book.
So
right?
Before that, what sort of strand of Islam is most practiced in Singapore?
So in Singapore, unconsciously, what is being practiced in Singapore is a very conservative strand of Islam. And it's not, when I say conservative, it's not like Middle East conservative, right? But it's still quite tribal in a sense that there is no independent thought given permission. So as a Muslim, if you're not an expert or an ulama, they call it, like a religious teacher, not even a religious teacher, an ulama is like a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not a scholar, you don't have the right to reinterpret the Quran. Which is very strange because Islam doesn't have a pope.
Right.
It is a religion, even though it's like an organized religion, it's very much disorganized because there is no central aid to say Islam should be practiced this way. When the Prophet passed away, he purposely didn't leave behind an heir. So he doesn't want to be like Islam being governed by a single person.
Mm-hmm.
Islam was given to the world, or revealed to the world, I believe, as the universal religion. It was built upon the traditions of Judaism and Christianity and revealed to mankind as this universal religion that can stand the test of time. That means if it has to stand the test of time, we cannot follow the practices of what has happened by the Prophet.
So it evolves. Yeah.
It has to evolve, and the evolution has to happen personally.
Mm.
We cannot wait for like a pope or a caliph, like waiting for ISIS to change things. Things won't change.
So, you know, with the situation, you know, so that means, right, in different parts of Asia, different forms of Islam are practiced.
Yes. So surprisingly, when I first heard the news about Jakarta in Indonesia, specifically, right? So whenever something like this happened, and we have to be honest, this is not the first time gays are tortured in the name of Islam, right?
Right.
So it happens by ISIS, it has happened in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
When things like this happen, I always go into this defensive mode and say that, oh, this is Middle Eastern culture.
Mm-hmm.
And actually a lot of people always say this, Muslim, people who are very intimate in the Muslim world, always say that Indonesia is the model of progressive Islam.
Yes. Yeah. They've always been touted as the moderate Muslim country.
Correct. It's not just moderate, in fact. It's progressive. Because they allow women to vote.
Yeah.
It's Muslim can marry non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this very progressive strain of Islam in Indonesia. So
I've got friends who are Indonesian and Muslim as well. And the women in their household, after marriage, they don't put on the hijab.
Exactly. So something happened. Right? So people are saying things like Saudi Arabia is becoming more influential in Indonesia because of the Hajj quota.
Mm.
So to have more quota to go for the pilgrimage, Saudi Arabia is given permission to build like madrasas, their version of Islam in Indonesia. Something happened. But those aside, like politics and stuff like that, this happened because I believe the Muslims in Indonesia, I mean, I'm not going to pin like a brush stroke, but it allowed it to happen because the power, the central, the Indonesia is considered a secular government, but the Islamic strains, the Islamic party that I forgot what's the name of the party, has power because the people in Indonesia, the Muslim people in Indonesia, is giving power to this particular party to move the country forward. They are looking at this country and like, first of all, there was a non-Muslim mayor in Jakarta. That was the start of everything, yes, right? And people are not happy about that because they really believe that Indonesia is a Muslim country. It is a Muslim country in terms of constitution, but other religions are actually mentioned in the constitution.
So what?
Right.
So now that we have some sort of idea about the situation in Indonesia, but what does the Quran actually say anything about homosexuality?
So the central source of condemnation for homosexuality from the Quran is probably similar to the Bible, which is the Sodom Gomorrah story.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no direct quote from the Quran that says punish gays, because the Quran doesn't even identify sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as sexual orientation in the Quran. It's just transgression. So like the story of Sodom Gomorrah is literally, you know, the story is basically, it's like they're trying to rape these angel guests, male angel guests. So from there, the scholars, the Muslim scholars, are given a lot of power to reinterpret this particular story, says that gay homosexuality is wrong.
I see.
Yeah, so it's not a direct, it's still an interpretation.
So basically, they are interpreting sort of these, so interpreting the Quran to their perspective, basically, and then that perspective then gets sort of trickled down to the rest of the population. Is
yeah.
that how it works?
So, to understand how the ulama, the scholarship of Islam works is, there will be like a central, there's not central figure, but a group of study, for example, certain Islamic universities in the Middle East, I forgot the particular university, but let's say they come up with a certain paper or study that says that this is how we view homosexuality in Islam,
mm-hmm.
right? And then let's say Saudi Arabia decided that, you know what, Islam is punishable by death. So
okay.
this becomes a source of inspiration for other Islamic countries.
Mm.
So this is, but this is problematic because there is no direct quote from the Quran. And in fact, there is no, during the Prophet's time, there was not even, like, no gays was punished.
Mm.
No gays were punished. So the problem with this is, I think it's because Islam has turned into this almost tribal-like religion
mm-hmm.
when they are not given permission to think for themselves
mm-hmm.
and religion has become a central source of power for politicians. It's like, if I want to win over Muslims,
mm-hmm.
the best way to win over Muslims is to tell Muslims that I get my knowledge and inspiration from the Quran directly. I'm going to lead this country based on religion.
That sounds really oddly familiar.
It is, right?
Well, I think
yeah.
on the larger scale, it's always, you know, the way to unite people is to identify a common enemy.
Correct.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
But trying to lead a country by religion sounds very much like what the Islamic State is trying to do.
Correct. So the for example, ISIS, what they're trying to do is not a new thing. What they're trying to create is not something like, oh my God, it's so revolutionary. It's not. Their methods might be.
Right.
The way they do it, using social media and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. But it is not a new thing, trying to create a so-called Islamic State or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Indonesia is considered an Islamic country. It's just
mm-hmm.
that it always has been quite progressive, giving
mm-hmm.
space for Christians, Buddhists and everything to like function properly,
mm-hmm.
and even Muslims to practice their own version of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that right now, I believe it's because the world is moving quite fast ever since the United States legalized gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
The news was reported positively throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't reported like an abomination, it was like a positive report.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indonesians, politicians in Indonesia who want to control these so-called Muslims and maybe have internalized homophobia or homophobia in general, are using the religion to so-called move the people. So, for example, in Aceh, where if you actually look at the caning video,
mm-hmm.
what really shocks me is not the caning part. I mean, the caning part was torturous, barbaric, right? They were
mm-hmm.
torturing gays. But it's the people around them. And these people, these women,
mm-hmm.
wearing tudung and hijab and stuff like that, where the very religion discriminates against them, are supporting this.
Right.
So, it's the source of homophobia within Islam is the patriarchy. It is misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
It is against women. That's why these things happen. And you have these women who actually on camera say things like, oh, we should have done this. This is a good example. It's punishment against God. So it's shocking for me because I can no longer defend the religion because I used to say it's Arab culture,
mm-hmm.
but it's really not. It is really when you are given permission to interpret the Quran in this way
mm-hmm.
and people accept it, these kind of things happen.
So we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about how can we then change things? You know, how can we sort of break out of this system? And this is, as you mentioned, sort of being the beginning, sort of
yep.
reforming or reformist, basically.
Yep.
So we're just going to take a short break.
In April 2017, our community downloaded 50,000 Joy podcast episodes. Hear Joy programs like Checkpoint, Chicks Talkin' Footy, and Pop Chops. Check out our new programs such as Rach and Dean, Dano and Mason, Barney Beck and Bobby. Enjoy exclusive podcast-only shows such as Reality Check, LA Spins, This Is Our Lives, or The Vic Police Glow Show. Plus, new to the lineup, Queercast, a new podcast collaboration between Joy and Singapore's LGBTI community. Get away from your busy day. Escape with Joy podcasts where you want them, when you want them. joy.org.au and on iTunes.
So welcome back, everybody. We've been talking to Wan about homosexuality in Islam, and he sort of shared with us sort of the situation and the different situation in Indonesia and sort of the different sort of strains of Islam that it is. So, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, something about reformist Islam. You know, what is that about?
So reformist Islam, actually within the Quran itself, there is a tradition called ijtihad, which is the Arabic word for reinterpreting the religion. So that word has been stolen and said that only people of certain standard or stature or power can use ijtihad to reinterpret the religion. But I really believe that ijtihad is a tradition in Islam for everybody to interpret the religion that fits in their life. Because if it's a universal religion, then it should stand and be universal for everyone. Maybe it's not everybody's life will be the same.
Right.
But the religion should apply. So the core central tenet of Islam, to be a Muslim, all you have to do is to believe in God. Right? So the opposite of that means the biggest sin that you can do is actually to play God. So if you claim that you're the only one who can interpret the religion, I believe that you are playing God. So reformist Muslim simply means you read the Quran and then you try to understand the Quran and then interpret it to fit your certain life. So
in your own point of view, from
in
your
my
own
perspective, yes, and without feeling any kind of guilt or like this is not right. So yeah, and you don't force it on people. So like, I believe I can safely say without contradiction that I'm gay and Muslim, because I completely reject certain misogynist part of the Quran. I don't believe the Quran. The Quran is said to be the direct word of God, but it is compiled by men. So it is not a perfect book. The words might be perfect, but it's not. So we have to be smart to reject certain elements of it that is not in line with the properties of God. So God, the Islamic God, I call it the universal God, have names such as like the wise, the justice, the merciful, the forgiving. And how can you see something that is happening in Aceh in the name of God to be in line with this? You know, it's nothing at all. Like, you're literally punishing these two gays in the name of God because you think these two gays are offending God.
Right.
Right? And that is not what it is required of you to be Muslim. It says, to be Muslim, you have to believe in God, not to act in His name. Just believe in Him. That's it. And then He gives you the Quran. You use it or don't use it. All you need to do is live your life and do unto others what you want others to do unto you. Basic principles of humanity. So that is what Islam is to me.
And so, yeah, so, you know, you explained that along the way, you know, the scholars then have, you know, amassed the power to then reinterpret the Quran either to some sort of political agenda, and that has sort of, how do I say this, sort of distorted the meaning of Islam in that sense. So, you know, with all that's happening in Indonesia, will that kind of, you know, line of thinking or strand of Islam as it gains power in Indonesia spread to the rest of Asia?
So, okay, this is my fear as well. Because in the 60s, when you look at Singapore Malay movies, P. Ramlee, Saloma, right? The cinema scene. You have Malay people in sexy kebayas drinking whiskey on TV.
drinking whiskey on TV.
Because they understand that's entertainment. That is not like some kind of like, oh my God, we are, everything we do must represent Islam in a certain way. We don't think like that. Only when, right now, it's a recent phenomenon, this so-called extremist Islam, the way Islam is interpreted right now to be very strict, to be, they call it Wahhabism, Islam, whatever. I don't really care for the name because this version of Islam, which has its roots in tribal culture in the Middle East, is spreading all over Southeast Asia. And it's clear it is spreading. It's happening in Malaysia, where you have somebody saying things like, you have people giving fatwas, saying things like, gays is wrong, punishable by death, if you come out of the religion, you can be killed, stuff like that.
And fatwa is sort of like an edict or?
Fatwa is an edict, supposedly, but I believe it's just a legal opinion. It's literally, it's just from, for example, our MUIS, the Islamic Council in Singapore, give fatwas as well. But their fatwas are not enforceable because it is the legal opinion of our Mufti. So the Mufti is basically the, like, group head. You know, he's not the Pope. He doesn't set divine laws or anything like that. He just say things like, okay, if you guys don't want to spend time to read the Quran to find out about certain things, this is fine. Mm-hmm. So one of the interesting fatwas that the Muslim Sahib did was, there was a period in Singapore where there was this parent who wanted their kid to wear the tudung.
Yes.
Yeah. And there was this struggle
about the uniform, right? What constituted the uniform?
Yes. So what the MUIS did, and a lot of Muslim things that what the MUIS is doing is wrong, but what the MUIS simply did is, it says this: if you're in a country that demands you to do certain things against the religion, in your opinion against the religion, mm-hmm. you have to follow the rule first, mm-hmm. then Islam. That means if the school doesn't say you're going to wear the tudung, you don't have to wear the tudung. And MUIS, the Mufti said, it is not sinful in the eye of God. So that's his legal opinion. Mm-hmm. And if you have to follow his legal opinion, and because he's a learned person, then you can. So it's the same with these so-called scholars.
Right.
It is just their opinion. But the problem is, it become basis for like very important laws, like for example, anti-gay laws or anti-women laws and stuff like that.
Is it because of the kind of political influence they wield outside of the religious sphere that has managed to make that sort of transition? So basically, you know, they have this very strong opinion, mm-hmm. right? But then that sort of carries over to the secular sphere, right? So there has to be some sort of...
Yes, correct. So it's difficult to explain this to a non-Muslim because there's no such thing as a secular and a non-secular sphere.
Okay.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right. It's all
the whole thing is open game for Islam interpretation.
Okay.
So if the ulama has power over your spiritual life, it has power over your so-called secular life.
I
over
see.
Government, over policies, over everything.
Mm.
So the problem is not the ulama. The ulama have all their rights to come up with whatever opinions they have. But the thing is, the normal Muslims, normal Muslims fear to be spiritual in their own religion. That means they only obey and submit.
Mm.
Without thinking, reinterpreting, thinking creatively. Because it's always been like, oh, we don't do this, we just do what is right.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that are supposedly right is not from the Quran, doesn't have any divine or Islamic basis.
Right.
It's from traditions, from Arabic traditions,
mm-hmm.
things like that. You know?
I see.
Yeah.
So then what can we do then basically to at least try to at least pry apart, or you know, try to ensure a tiny separation between, you know, mosque and state?
In the case of Indonesia, I don't think that's the right way to go, to
right.
separate mosque and state. What should have happened instead is the people that are affected by this, maybe Singapore MUIS,
mm-hmm.
or whoever, openly condemn their interpretation of the religion. So the problem with moderate Muslims, and I do not like the word moderate Muslims because
it implies
something.
Yes.
But moderate,
yeah.
The problem with moderate Muslims is they do this. Okay, whenever there's a violent act done in the name of Islam, the first thing they will do is this: we condemn the violence. Great, of course you have to condemn the violence. But then they go into the defensive mode and say, oh, but don't get this us wrong. This has nothing to do with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not right. That's not genuine. It's because if I kill these two gays in the name of the Islamic God,
then
it is an Islamic act.
Right.
That means you have to be brave and look at in the eye of the religion and says, okay, you're interpreting these scriptures this way.
Mm-hmm.
It is inhumane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be done this way. That means we have to be able to look at the religion and say, hey, there is something not right about the religion or the way we interpret it,
mm-hmm.
or the text. Are we doing it rightly?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of shying away and say, oh, this is not nothing to do with the religion. So
right.
then we shut down the religious conversation.
And we shut down the discussion.
Exactly. So you have things like ISIS where they use religion. They are already using religion to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But we are targeting them, we are attacking them, not in that religious sphere. We are attacking them like, oh, you're against human rights. This mm-hmm. is not right. But in their head, I'm doing this in the name of God.
Right.
Yeah.
So I mean, yeah, and you really hit the nail on the head. Basically, is that when we shut down discussion, and then the argument then becomes very narrow, or the perspective then becomes very narrow,
yes.
and then we are unable to see past sort of that myopic view of what religion can be. So you know, we're now in the holy month of Ramadan, right? And you're fasting.
Yes, I am.
So can you tell us a little bit about what Ramadan means to you?
Ramadan. Okay, I used to hate Ramadan.
Okay.
Because I'm like, oh my god, I do fast. I hate fasting. But Ramadan has become for me like a very physical reminder of what it means to be a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't eat and drink, and then you're constantly reminded like, why are you doing this?
There's an impact on how you live.
Yes,
think,
so it's the most direct impact during the Ramadan is like, you're hungry all the time, and you're doing this not because you want to lose like 5 kgs. I know. But you're doing this like in the name of your God, you know, like,
right.
and you practice the religion. For me at least, I become more, I appreciate more of the rituals of the religion. I don't pray 5 times a day,
right.
But within Ramadan, I try to go for the Taraweeh prayers.
Mm-hmm.
I try to go for iftar is just having dinner with your friends, but we pray before it, something like that. So I appreciate certain rituals of the religion. And I know these rituals are just practices,
right.
But it sort of bring me to a more spiritual awareness.
So it's a physical reminder of your spirituality.
Yes, correct. It's the most physical reminder of my spirituality.
I think that's a really sort of really, really great really great thought. So you know, it's been really, really interesting, you know, having you on the show and, you know, helping us understand a little bit more about Islam. And I really would love to sort of continue these conversations in later shows and stuff like that. But I also know that you're very busy doing other things. What else have you been up to?
So I am the creator of SG Narrative. So SG Narrative is this YouTube show that I conceptualized with my 2 other friends. It's a show that we try to visualize what empathy-driven conversations could look like.
Mm-hmm.
So in Singapore, I see that there's people have fear talking about, in terms of relationship, I've seen couples who have like no idea how much they earn each other because
right.
they're so scared to talk about money.
Right.
So we try to show that or talk about sexual problems like mm-hmm. am I satisfying sexually? So things like these kind of conversations, we try to make it visual. So we are planning a series of videos. I think this might be my interest of listeners.
Mm-hmm.
So we're planning a series of like LGBT based videos until the lead up to Pink Dot.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some interesting guests on the show.
Okay.
So
great.
We got like from Project X, we got these 2 transgender sex workers who are 18 and 19
mm-hmm.
talking about their experiences about being chased out of the house. And one of the more memorable part of that particular session is when the question was asked, like, what would it take for you to stop sex work? And it was a question that I really do not want to ask, but I just not have to. And the answer was like, oh, if I can buy a house, I'll stop. I was heartbroken when I heard that.
These are basic needs of survival.
I know, I was
reality.
Like super heartbroken. And then, of course, we also have Lokis and his best friend, Bas, talk about their infamous GIF and all that.
Right. Okay, don't give away too
yeah.
much. Tell us, where can we find these videos and how can we connect to SG Narratives?
So, you can find SG Narrative on YouTube. So just youtube.com/SG Narratives.
Mm-hmm.
You can find us on Facebook, it's SG Narrative. Just SG Narratives everywhere.
SG Narratives.
Everywhere.
Right?
Yeah, SG as in SG and Narrative as in know to spell people.
Alright, so it's been another fabulous episode of Queercast, and we've got lots more coming up in line for you. Always, as always, you can reach out to us, you know, to our email, to our Facebook, to our Instagram. And once again, you've been listening to Nick T. And one, bye!
This episode of Queercast was possible thanks to the support of Joy 94.9 in Melbourne, Australia's only LGBTI radio station, who hosts our podcast. Keep queer voices on air and on podcast by becoming a member today at joy.org.au. We also have to thank our community collaborator, Uga Chaga, a non-profit counselling and personal development organisation for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and questioning individuals. They do incredible work for the community, and you can help them continue their good work by donating. Visit www.ugachaga.com. Lastly, we want to say thank you to you, our listeners. And if you want to stay updated on new episodes or have an early sneak peek for future guests, follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Links to all our social media handles and our partners can be found in the description. Thanks, and we love you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.